You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yuan.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And on today's episode, we are bringing you an author chat with Lila Lee, the best-selling author of just so many books, including the Meeting Kim children's series, the Gigi Shen middle grade series, as well as young adult and adult romances. And we will be chatting with her about her latest YA rom-com, The Cuffing Game. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you can access to our members-only Discord server, where you can chat with us and fellow book club members in real time about all sorts of topics, including our monthly book club picks. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a member's choice book club pick every quarter.
Yeah, so we had a great time talking to Lila about reality TV, film school, Pride and Prejudice, being a queer Asian American. We touch on a lot of topics, so I hope you guys enjoy this conversation with Lila. And we are here with Lila Lee, the best-selling author of swoony rom-com books inspired by pop culture and her Korean heritage, such as Love and Focus, Flip the Script, I'll Be the One, and most recently, The Cuffing Game. Welcome to the show, Lila.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, like we've seen your name on book deals in our news episodes like quite consistently. So I'm very happy that we finally have you on our show. I like to start the episode with little icebreakers. And since The Cuffing Game involves crushes, I wanted to know, who was your first celebrity or fictional crush?
Okay.
And we will all share. So it's not just you.
Okay. So the way I knew immediately. So my first crush was fictional. And I had just immigrated from Korea to America. I was born in Korea and immigrated when I was 5. And during that time, in the 90s, that's when Sailor Moon was still on TV in Korea. So my first crush was Tuxedo Mask in Sailor Moon.
Damien, yeah. Or Mamoru. Yeah, they like changed the names when they did the dub here.
Right.
Yeah.
How about you guys?
For me, I have two. So my first boy crush was Dimitri from Anastasia, the 1997 animated movie. It definitely like started the whole like enemies to lovers kind of like interest in fiction. And then like the other one is actually quite timely, Rachel Weisz from The Mummy, because the new Mummy movie has been greenlit with with the original cast. And I was like, yes, oh my God. I'm so excited. So those are my two crushes. How about you, Marvin?
I'm trying to think.
It also, like, you know, fictional. Like, it doesn't have to be a real person. It can be a cartoon like me.
You know, it would probably be, this is tough. Because I'm trying to think of cartoons I watched when I was a kid. I watched a lot of shonen stuff, so it's like a lot of like dudes fighting, so it's not a lot of
I watched Dragon Ball, like Mozzie too.
Yeah,
but they have girls in shonen.
Bulma wasn't like someone like I would have a crush with,
right?
To be honest, probably like someone like, if we're talking about characters that like collected like fan art of, like Aerith, Tifa, Renault, like the Final Fantasy characters from like the PlayStation era.
Are valid. So, Lila, I've heard that writing has been like a large part of your early life. I heard that you started like writing books while you were still in like grade school. Can you just tell us a little bit about how you got started in writing and how you landed an agent?
Yeah. So I've been telling stories and I've been reading books since as long as I can remember. One of my key childhood moments, as my mom likes to call it, is when, like I said, I immigrated when I was 5. So I just got in the hang of the Korean language. I just learned how to read. And then my parents were like, well, here's school in America. Good luck. So we immigrated to Fremont in California. And I was just so mad I couldn't read the books anymore because they're all in other language. So apparently I did this thing where I would just ignore the actual text and like just like come up with my own stories using the picture books that like I'm using the pictures in the picture books. So I think that kind of like shows you how much I love like storytelling. And like I literally was doing that. And then in second grade, I think we read this book called like this, I think The Snowman. And I basically like in that book, the snowman dies at the end. And I got so mad that I was like, you know what? I'm going to make my own version of this book where not only is the main character like a girl and a girl snowman, but like the snowman actually like doesn't die. And like they live happily ever after. So I feel like I was always interested in like kind of like crafting my own story. And then, but I think the point in my life where I actually like thought seriously about writing is when I was in fourth grade. I was in Florida at the time, and I was very involved in the school library. Like I was always in the library during lunch, and we had the opportunity to like basically I don't know how to call it. Like we basically had our own shelf at the library that we were in charge of, kind of like we kind of volunteered, like, I guess. So that kind of led me to like spend a lot of time with books. And that led me to kind of wonder, like, where do books come from? And then, like, I also had, like, a really cool teacher named Mrs. Brown, who, like, was an aspiring author herself. And she would basically tell us about, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to try to get published. And then she would, like, tell us these really cool stories about, like things that she made up. And like, I got so, like, entranced by, like, the world of, like, storytelling and publication. And, like, so that's when I first started writing my own book in fourth grade. I didn't finish it because like I was a fourth grader, so I got distracted with other things. But it was until like in middle school in eighth grade that I like kind of thought more seriously about like, oh, I actually want to like try this seriously. So that's when I first kind of like wrote my first book and finished it. And like at the time we also had this like end of middle school project where we could like research anything we wanted to do. And I was like, oh, you know what? I'm going to research how to get published. So I researched how to like query agents, how to submit to publishers. And I actually submitted my own manuscript to my agents as part of a school project. And that's that's how I kind of got started with like my journey through publication. Sadly, it didn't go anywhere because I was still in middle school. So I barely knew how to revise. Like I thought revising was like proofreading, so I didn't like edit at all. It was just like just me and my like thoughts, like just like stream of consciousness, like novel writing. And I submitted to publishers and agents, and that didn't go anywhere. And I think it wasn't until college when I went to USC, and I kind of through the liberal arts college and also like the film school, which I was both part of, where I kind of like really like learned how to like revise and rewrite and like kind of like like focus on all that craft stuff that I actually learned how to like revise my novel and like actually like not just submit the first draft that like I went through all of that and I got my agent the summer after college. And I wish I could say like it was a happy bit after that, but unfortunately publishing is very like, and especially at the time in the 2016, this was like the late 2010s, a lot of like, I mean, publishing was starting to get more diverse. People were like starting to be like, we need more diverse books, but we weren't quite there yet. So I got a lot of like, my agent and I got a lot of like, oh, the writing is so good, but we can't connect to the story, or you know, there's not really a market for this kind of book. So we spent like 2 more years kind of going through the slush pile and being rejected, until in 2018. Which is when I got not just one book deal, but 2 book deals, which both sold at auction. And that was like my YA debut, I'll Be the One, which is my K-pop book. And also my series for younger kids, Mandy Kim series, which like just ended this year. So yeah, it's like a long journey.
Yeah, it's not like people think that overnight successes are, you know, it literally happens overnight. But clearly you've been working on your craft for a number of years, number of rejections, and even like your book deal, like it took like a number of years. And then all of a sudden you got like two book deals at once. And it's like, yeah, it looks like you got it overnight, but you did it.
Right.
Yeah, I am curious, since you are one of the few authors that we've had on the show who has like written for almost every age group. Like, you have your Mindy Kim early reader series, you have Gigi Shin, the middle grade series, and then you have your young adult romances, and now you have your adult romance, which came out back in May, Love and Focus. Mm-hmm. So how different is the writing experience for each age group? Like, does your process change at all when it comes to like plotting, and do you have like a favorite age group for writing?
That's a good question. I think craft wise it's the same. I always start out on a very strict like plotter, because like I've had to like juggle like multiple deadlines per year. Like I've had like on average I want to say 1 to 3 books come out every year since 2020. So I've had to like basically like work really hard to like meet those deadlines and like kind of like kind of have like an assembly line process where I had to like be very efficient with my time. So I always start with an outline where I basically go through and outline like write a paragraph about each chapter of the book, like what happens in each chapter. And then I go through and I kind of fill out the outline with like a draft where I just like draft really fast, like what happens in each chapter, and I kind of go through there. What I just like go through multiple passes where I just write and fill out the book into like an actual book. That's my process, craft wise. In terms of like the audience, I will say that for me, before I was a full time author, I used to teach. I was a private tutor for kids grades through first grade to 12th grade. So I think that really helped me kind of hone in the voices for the individual age groups, where like I could picture in my mind, oh, this first grade that I taught or this 12th grade I taught and what they're interested in. And that really helped me like kind of hone in the voice of each like age group that I wrote for. And adult romance, I kind of use my own experiences and like what I, because I'm 31 right now. So like basically like what I like thought of in my 20s or 30s. And that all kind of helped me like write my books.
Yeah, like I think it's really impressive. Like,
thank you.
Not just juggling multiple projects at once. I think you had like 3 books that came out this year, right? Like,
yeah. So there's gonna be 4 total this year, including the Cupping Game. Wow, it's been a wild ride. Yeah, it's my busiest year in my life, basically.
Yeah,
are you okay?
I said, very
no,
are you okay?
No.
How much coffee did you drink to meet all your deadlines?
Too much. No.
So we like. I want to get into your newest book, The Cuffing Game. For our listeners who have not heard about it, can you give us a short elevator pitch?
So The Cuffing Game is my K-drama remix of Pride and Prejudice, and Love Island. And I kind of wrote it because I grew up watching K-dramas, watching reality TV, and reading like classic novels like Pride and Prejudice, Persuasion, all that stuff. And I kind of combined all 3 loves into one book. And that's The Cuffing Game.
Yeah, I think it's really okay. So like I'm wearing my More Pride, Less Prejudice, like
nice. I had a shirt.
Boston
shirt. Yeah, I have it. Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was very appropriate for today's conversation. Your book opens with the line, "It's a truth universally acknowledged that when there is a hot person, there is also someone with a crush on them," which is, you know, obvious, you know, nod to Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice's opening line, "It's a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife." What compelled you to like remix the story with Pride and Prejudice? Because you could have easily done like a straightforward retelling where you like replace each character with like correlate them with the actual characters in Pride and Prejudice, but you made your own characters and the story's a little bit different from the original.
Yeah. I think it was just, I will say this is like out of all my books, I think that I had the most fun with this book because it's basically it's a passion project that was born from me watching too much Love Island like one summer. And I was like, you know what? Why don't I just like write this book? And the reason why I kind of like didn't like directly adapt it is because I mean, I love Pride and Prejudice at its original form, and I didn't want to like make a copy and paste. I want to make my own version of it based on my own experiences as an author and also as a human being who like was an immigrant from Korea, who lived in LA, and also like who lived in other parts of the country. And so I had a lot of fun, you know, like putting my own spin into things. Like I made Darcy into frat boy. I made Elizabeth into a scholarship kid from Texas. And I kind of kept the my favorite parts about the book. Like I kept the enemies to lovers, I kept the Elizabeth's like family dynamic, where she comes from this background of like a lot of sisters, and like I also kept the class differences between the two characters. But I also like spun my own, like I put my own spin to the characters, like Darcy, instead of being like this British nobleman character, I made him into like this very rich Korean immigrant international student who is very privileged, but also, and it's very like a much like an influencer where he's very popular and people all like kind of adore him. But like the original Darcy, he's very like socially awkward and low-key neurodivergent. And also like I made Elizabeth into someone who I thought about like, oh, okay, what would these characters be like in like a modern like day American college? And in my head, it made sense for Elizabeth to be like a scholarship kid who wanted to like prove herself and kind of like was really ambitious and had these really big goals because she wanted to prove to her mom that she wasn't going to school just to get married. So I think all these things kind of that I was thinking about kind of shaped the book into what it is.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun trying to kind of map, because, you know, we've read plenty of Pride and Prejudice adaptation spins on this podcast. It's like it's a very well-loved, you know, source material for a lot of authors. And I think, you know, having that knowledge, and I myself have never read the original text. That's one of my like pop culture guests. But I have now seen the Keira Knightley version, and
the 2005 version.
My wife loves the BBC version, so I'm sure we'll watch that at some point. But it was really interesting kind of understanding, like, you know, having now a innate understanding of the archetypes of the, you know, the relationships, and seeing like the subtle ways that you remix their characters, right? Like Darcy in the original text has always had a crush on Elizabeth. He just doesn't know how to show it. And Elizabeth doesn't know why she is attracted to him, because she hates him. And you kind of switch those roles in your book. I found myself like waiting for eventually a Wickham does show up, but he appears way later than I thought he would. And that was really interesting too.
Of course, his name is Kyle. Sorry for all the Kyles out there. but that was my thought when he like showed up. I was like, ugh, like, this Wickham character, of course his name is Kyle, and of course he got kicked out of fraternity. Yeah, so very interesting setting, very interesting you know, like remixing of the classic Pride and Prejudice.
I will say that I think you guys probably read like an early version of it, but in the final version I do kind of sprinkle a little brief mention of Kyle in the prologue, where he appears and then he's like the fake friend who's like, oh, hey, you're so awesome, Noah. And then it's like a foreshadowing to the like when he appears for real later in the book. So that's a good change I made in the later version of the book. Yeah.
You also do a very good job capturing like college, the way college kids talk, at least when I went to college, and we were probably all contemporaries here, I want to say. But like, you know, I was in a business fraternity. We had littles and grand littles. So I was like, oh, I haven't heard these terms in like 20 plus years at this point.
Yeah. As someone who like went to a school where like campus fraternities were like not really a thing, except for like in business schools, like I always thought that that was like something that was exaggerated for Hollywood movies, but apparently it's real. And I was like, huh, that's very strange.
I went to USC, and the Greek culture is it's like basically everyone in like our dorm pretty much rushed. I rushed. Guardian sorority didn't pledge, but it was just like part of the culture. And I think if you go to USC, you'll know that the school that they go to is actually USC. but I base a lot of the and also like UST also has like Asian frats and Asian and frat boys, so I kind of like definitely captured a lot of like the nuances I observed as like a kid, a college kid, and I put that in a book. Yeah,
I mean, a formative experience. I went to UC San Diego, and the formative experience for us too is that first weekend of freshman year. You're going to the parties, like you're free from your parents. You just got get out there and drink your first beer. I was sheltered as a high school kid, so that was my first beer in college.
It's very different from my first week at college. And like, I just found it really funny that Noah, this Korean immigrant who's also like a stud and an influencer, he is a frat boy. And I was like, wow, if this book came out like 5 years ago, not even like a couple of years ago, like I feel like I would be like, wow, that's new. I haven't seen that before. But I feel like the, for lack of a better words, like the objectification of Korean, like hot Korean guys has like become a thing. So I'm like, oh, it's not that much of a stretch. Like, of course he's hot. Of course he's popular.
Like, yeah. So not only is your book a spin on Pride and Prejudice, but it's also a Christmas story. It takes place during the holidays, lead up to Christmas. Was this always like something on your bucket list to write like a Christmas rom-com?
I honestly don't know where Christmas part came from, to be honest. I think if anything, it was probably because I was writing the book in the winter. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I always complain that like publishing, I mean, I don't know if it's true for other authors, but for some reason, for me, I always get deadline during the holidays. So I'm always working during the holidays.
That's brutal.
Yeah, because like basically what happened, I don't blame them because it's just the way the timelines work. But basically what happens is everyone in publishing, they usually take off around like December, early December. And they're like, right before they do out of office, they're like, okay, here's your book bag. Good luck. Happy holidays. And they're just out of office. And then meanwhile, I'm like here, like on the other side, like, oh, I have my deadline. And my deadline is for January 2nd. So I had to like work during the holidays. So I think if I want to like pretend to like know what I was thinking back then, I think it's because I was like trying to kind of, I love the holidays. I love holiday cheer. I've always loved Christmas. So I was trying to make myself happy by writing this very cozy Christmas book as I was working through the holidays while listening to holiday music.
No, vibe writing is it's a very valid practice.
And I think it proves to a lot of people who like don't know LA that well. It's like, yeah, we do get snow. We can have a cozy Christmas. Just, you know, it has to be up in.
Yeah, gotta drive a couple hours.
Actually snows. So a large part of your book is this dating show that Mia comes up with. The Cuffing Game is named after that. And I am curious to hear, like, what inspired you to write a college romance centered on an online dating show? It's just, like, so specific. I know you mentioned, like, Love Island, but, like, what was your fascination with, like, a reality TV show, you know, making it into the book?
Yeah. I went to film school when I was in college, and I was actually part of this like undergrad like film, not film, it was more like a TV show where student run TV show where we basically like went on campus with like a camera we rented from school. And I was just a lowly freshman, so I was doing all the like the grunt work. Like I was the one holding the boom pole. I was the one like carrying the camera around, like doing all the chores. So I wasn't like anyone important. But I feel like that experience of like going on campus, like filming something, and also like going off campus sometimes to film stuff for like other like students who are upperclassmen, kind of helped me kind of realize how like much like a unique college experience I had back in the day. And so I kind of combined that experience of like going around campus and going around LA filming stuff into like my love of reality TV and how like, so my favorite parts of like reality TV is when they break the fourth wall. Like for example, like there's a season of Love Is Blind where things get so messy that like people run off camera, and then you see the other camera like accidentally filming the other camera, and they're like, what just happened? So I love those moments because like, because you're like, oh, it's real, it's reality TV. They had no idea that the person was gonna run away. So I love the domain of the chaos. So I want to capture that chaos of like, oh my gosh, like the people didn't do what we expected them to do. Like someone's running off, someone's fighting. So I want to capture that into like the chaos of like being students who are less experienced in like a Netflix show. And I kind of combine those two, and that's why I kind of like made it into like a college run reality TV show, because I love that chaos of it. Yeah,
I think you really captured like the chaos of reality TV filming, and just also like the grunt work, how grueling it is to be part of a like a camera crew, not even just like a reality TV crew, but just any like production crew. They put in a lot of hours, and it is a special bond. I feel like the more disastrous the shoot, the more trauma bonding happens, and you guys get really, really tight. What was the most special part about your film school experience? And was there any specifics that you were like, this has to go in the book?
I think for me, so kind of a backstory, I didn't go in as a film major. I went in as kind of like an English major. I mean, the program was called Narrative Studies, but it was basically an English major. And I could take like a film elective, and that's what kind of inspired me to like go into film school. So since I wasn't like a traditional film student, I didn't have to like be constrained to like, oh, you have to take only screenwriting classes or only production classes. I actually ended up taking like not only screenwriting, but screenwriting, editing, producing, a whole bunch of classes that the school had to offer. So I was like, one week I was like writing my script, my feature script, and then another week I was like in the basement labs and in the very freezing basement labs crying over like having to edit this like 5-minute video that would take like 4 hours to edit. So I was like, so I had these core memories of like doing everything that the film school kind of like offered me, and I think like just the variety of experiences I had are what was special about my experience. Like the fact that it wasn't like a traditional film school experience, but more like a pick and choose, I could do whatever I wanted, like kind of experience. Yeah.
Yeah. One of my favorite parts of the book is like the production meetings. Like I've never done a film or TV shoot before, but I've done events and I've done podcasts and I've done, you know, digital stuff. And like, it really did capture the stress of, okay, we've captured the stuff. Now we got to like figure out how to put it all together. Mm-hmm. And all those conversations, because that's where the magic happens in like in all these shows, is the editing room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
exactly.
Also a poor editor, like always get like editing the same day sounds so stressful. Like I can only imagine. So like most mainstream dating shows are heteronormative, and even like the LGBTQIA dating shows, there's like very little bisexual representation, and, you know, multiple characters in your book are bisexual, queer. Can you talk about how you built the cast for The Cuffing Game and how their various sexualities, you know, affected their relationships on set?
Yeah. I knew going forward that I like didn't want to make it like a heteronormative like show. I wanted like it to be I want to call it a free for all, but it's not really a free for all, but it kind of is, in that like I kind of didn't really restrict my characters into like, oh, like you're a guy who has to date a girl, or you're a girl who has to date a guy. I wanted to like have like, I don't want to say twists, but not really, more like the freedom of having these different characters like date different sexualities or the same sexuality. And I did that because I feel like I also watch a lot of Korean reality TV shows and dating shows where it's even more heteronormative and more like very like boy girl. So in particular, Singles Inferno, where they basically, you know, it's very much like kind of like sexist in a way, where like a lot of like girls are like fight over one boy and it gets pretty messy, and I didn't want that. Like I didn't want like the classic like, oh, all the boys fighting over one girl, all the girls fighting over one boy. I wanted the characters to have freedom to date whoever they wanted, to and to fall in love with whoever they wanted, regardless of their sexuality. Yeah.
Yeah, like those dating shows are very heteronormative. And mm-hmm. I remember like a season of Terrace House, they like had a bisexual contestant who, you know, was still exploring his sexuality, and like mm-hmm. he went on dates with all of his male roommates, and I was like, oh, I wish we had more of that. Like it's different, and I don't know, like I know it's like dramatic to be like, oh, who are they gonna end up with next, like who's like the most compatible, you don't know, it can literally be anyone. I think that's like the fun of like dating shows, like it, you know, you don't know, so having that extra like extra layer of like everyone is queer and, you know, it's a free for all. I think it makes it more entertaining in my mm-hmm. opinion.
Yeah. I mean, I made the mistake of watching my very first season of The Bachelorette last year, the one with the first Asian Bachelorette. And I was surprised at how like, you know, I've heard that show gets super toxic, but I was not aware of the level of toxicity like present when you get all those dudes together for like one girl. So I was glad that, like, you know, the dating show in your book kind of kept things non-toxic for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
everyone's there to have a good time, find love, and yeah, you know,
it's essentially cozy, like a win retreat up. Going to the Big Bear, like we've done that plenty of times in college as well.
So you mentioned that you're bisexual, and your previous books, I'll Be the One and Flip the Script, and your newest novel, like Love and Focus, like they all have bisexual characters, queer characters. So how has your journey with your sexuality evolved with writing each of these books? Like, have you discovered like new things about yourself?
I think in terms of myself, not really. But a funny story that's kind of related is that I grew up Catholic. I grew up in Texas, and I grew up in a very traditional Korean immigrant household. Queerness was not ever an option for me. Like I grew up thinking that only white people were queer. And it wasn't until I went to school in LA, that I realized, oh, Asian people can be queer. Oh my gosh. And then like when I was 20, is when my junior year, that's when I realized, oh, I'm queer. So I kind of had that whole process. So I actually like went through all that before I started writing my books that I published now, which is why I'm saying like, I didn't really change throughout the process of publishing my books. But yeah, since I went through all that, before I published, I was pretty confident in my own identity, but I didn't really want to like, I was like out online, but I wasn't out to like my friends and family, and especially my parents. The way I came out to my parents was, well, back then when, I'll Be the One, my, YA debut came out, they, use a lot of like terms like own voices. So like one of the articles I got interviewed for was like, oh, just like an own voices, story, blah, blah. And my dad was like, oh, like own voices, what does that mean? So, and I was like, oh, guess what, dad, I'm bi. That's how I came out to my parents. So I think nothing changed in terms of myself, but definitely changed in terms of like me and like other people. Like I became more open to other people, and I guess that is a change to myself, because I am being more open to people. But in terms of my own identity, like I didn't really change, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And I'm really glad that like these books exist, because I can like point it out to people, being like, hey, like you're looking for Asian representation who are like queer, here you go. And it's not just like one subset of the LGBTQIA community. So like, thank you for writing those books. There's a vulnerable scene where Mia asks Noah if actual Koreans in South Korea are as homophobic as society portrays them to be. And mm-hmm. she adds that like she was never sure if her parents' disapproval over her bisexuality was attributed to Koreans' conservativeness or Texas mm-hmm. conservativeness. And this just made me question like how like people nowadays like see Koreans in like K-dramas and K-pop versus like how an everyday average Korean person on the street is like. So, like, what are your thoughts on like that contrast, that disconnect between like Koreans in media versus average everyday Korean.
Yeah. I think for that scene, I think I was inspired by a discussion I had with one of my other Korean American immigrant friends, and we're talking about like how, like, is our upbringing really like a Korean thing or is it an Asian American immigrant thing? Like, we had like a hard time distinguishing because she also grew up very conservative and like Christian and all that stuff. So we kind of had a hard time like distinguishing the two. And I think one of the best things I did for myself as an adult was I went to Seoul and like went and like got a place, got an Airbnb in Hongdae, and I got to explore Seoul and like the modern day like Korean life of like what it's like to be in Korea. And I got to like see like actual like openly gay Korean people, and I also got to like go to Pride in Korea, and that made me realize, oh, actually like real Koreans aren't that homophobic. I mean, like there are definitely, I mean, legally, it's still, like, not, same-sex marriage is still illegal. But I think I did a lot of research on this. And then actually, it's, like, the older populations are still homophobic, kind of like our parents. But people, like, in our generation, like, millennials and under, they're a lot more open. Like, I think it was more, like almost half people who are, like, kind of, like, not totally something, but, like, kind of, like, open-minded about it more. So I guess, like, that kind of gave me more perspective on, like, what actual Koreans are like. And that kind of influenced me to write that scene in the book.
Yeah, I think it was like a very like good point. Mm-hmm. For a lot of like I feel like Korean culture has kind of been in vogue for a while, and mm-hmm. There is like this wave of fans who don't really understand Korean culture, so they think that what they see in media is exactly what Koreans are like. And I'm like, no, like those K-drama actors, not everyone looks like them, not everyone is a chaebol, not everyone is gonna have like really like expensive clothes or whatnot. It's just like,
yeah,
this is what they're selling to you.
My favorite thing to tell people who like my American friends when they've been to Korea is I always like to tell them that K-pop is actually not popular in Korea.
Yeah, that's
K-pop
true.
Is only for like middle schoolers in Korea, and they're always shocked. They're like, what? Like, what is Korean pop music? It's like, no, it's only K-pop because it's the popular music that like Westerners like from Korea. But actually, Korea has this whole different like world of music that like isn't like ever like mainstream in America. So I feel like that's like that's a thing that like always like comes up when I talk to my friends who aren't Korean.
Yeah, like I went to Korea back in April for as part of my honeymoon, and my husband asked the, like, using his Google Translate, he asked our taxi driver, like, oh, like, do you listen to K-pop? Do you have a favorite group? And I was so embarrassed. I'm like, no, you did not ask, like, this Gen X taxi driver if he listens to K-pop. Absolutely not. And the taxi driver was like, actually, don't listen to K-pop. I really like trot music, which is, like, Korean country music.
Right.
Which doesn't sound like American country music at all. It's like a weird mix of, like, disco and, like, I don't know how to explain it. But he's like, yeah, listen to trot music. And like my husband was like, what is that? And I'm like, don't worry about it. Just like, just know that K-pop is not as popular as you think in Korea, as opposed to like what you see in America.
Yeah.
So Noah is a successful influencer who, you know, he feels wary about being documented on long form content because it gives viewers more opportunity to misinterpret him. And I feel like authors these days have the opposite problem where they're kind of pushed to be influencers and market their books. And, you know, these are books that they spent years on, and you have to like sum it up in like a 30-second TikTok. So I want to ask you, like, how has that experience worked out for you as an author who, you know, you also have like two Instagram handles. You have one for your early reader content, and you have one for like YA and adult romance readers. So how is it like being an influencer for your own?
I will say that, and I also have TikTok, but I will say I actually enjoy it a lot. I think it's probably because of my film school background, where I love editing like the clips, and I love like syncing stuff And I love, like, kind of, like, I love acting. I love, like, reading, like, dialogue and stuff. So I think for me, it's less painful. I know a lot of authors hate it. Like, literally, like, whenever I, like, go to, like, a, like, Steam and LitCon or, like, other, like, festivals where I meet a lot of author friends, they always complain about, like, oh, like, I hate TikTok. I hate Instagram. But I have a lot of fun with it, personally. But I will say, and I think for me, at least, social media itself has not been a negative experience where, because I know some people get tagged in negative reviews, but, like, luckily all my readers have not done that. Like, God bless them. So I've never had experienced that. I've never, like, experienced that much negativity online. That being said, for Noah's character, I definitely did a deep dive on a lot of, like, actual TikTok stars and influencers and, like, kind of, like, the timeline of, like, how they got famous or, like, how they navigate, like, fame and, like, all that stuff. And that's what, kind of influenced his character. But it was fun to, like, kind of gain into the head of an influencer, even though I don't consider myself one. I just do it because I have to. It's part of my job as being an author. But it was fun to be in his head for a while for that part of the book, definitely.
I do like how Mia and Noah, like, bicker a lot when it comes to their tastes in, like, filmmaking. And it's like, what do you know? You're an influencer. And it's like, what do you know? You're, like, an uppity, like, cinephile who only likes, like, old films. And it's like, that's a spectrum of film fans. And I thought that relationship between them was really funny. And do you have a preference for, like, films? Like, do you like older films or, like, more of the contemporary stuff that's happening?
So I think one of the greatest gifts of, like, going to film school is the fact that, like, I was forced to, as part of, like, the curriculum, I was forced to watch not just, like, modern films. Like, it was a wide spectrum because on one hand, I had a films class where Steven Spielberg actually came to our class, which is really cool. But on the other hand, we had to watch, like, silent films from the 1920s so, that are really obscure, no one has ever heard of. And so I actually have an appreciation for all types of film. But I will say that I can't do horror, no matter how old or new it is. It's too much. But as long as it's not horror, I can do anything.
Yeah, like, as someone who also went to film school, they really, like, they really build up your tolerance for genres that you really don't like. I had to sit through, like, half a semester of, like, French New Wave films, and I'm like, I will never watch this on my personal time ever.
Exactly. I still don't know what I watched. I remember watching it. I'm like, what just happened? Oh well, lunchtime.
I do agree. One of my most memorable classes in college was a cult films class where they made us watch, like, cool things like The Crow, but also, like, Candyman, which is scary as hell. But, you know, in your book, your main characters, Mia and Noah, also have these, you know, these sparring sessions about what's considered classic films. And I did find myself siding with Noah a lot because Mia's takes were just horrible, terrible. Like, we do not get along. We do not agree.
Like her saying, like, Alien is not a classic. I'm like, excuse me? You said that in public in a film school classroom? Absolutely not. Like, you're going to get crucified by your peers.
Yeah. I think this is one of those things that, like, I feel like people probably would misunderstand. So I think people would be like, I can already see someone being like, hey, why is Mia, like, the poor kid who likes, like, highbrow films, while Noah, like the upper class person, likes, like, you know, Alien. And, like, I think the reason why I did that, which seems like kind of intuitive, is because in college I took a class that was, like, I forgot what the exact class was, but it was, like, about, like, socioeconomic classes and how people from different, like, classes kind of react to pop culture or culture in general. And I learned that, like, basically people who are lower class actually cling on to more, like, highbrow culture more because they think that it's, like, basically they're aspiring to be that level, while, like, more high class people are, like the more lowbrow stuff where it's, like, they don't really feel the need to, like, overcompensate for, like, their limited upbringing. If that makes sense. So that's why I kind of, like, wrote that distinction in there. But yeah, it's kind of funny how, like, I think Mia is definitely gonna be the person that people disagree with a lot more, where people are gonna be like, you're like snobby and like, you know,
I mean, granted, she is a freshman, so, you know,
yeah,
she has time to learn.
Because a freshman,
freshman year, you, like, your ego is probably a lot bigger than it should be. I remember, like for the first day of a lot of my freshman filmmaking classes, like, we would go around saying, like, what our favorite movie or favorite TV show was, depending on, like, if you were in a TV class or a film class. And we would 100% judge everyone on their answer. There was this one kid I still remember to this day. This was like a class with like maybe 50 people, so it took like the entire class to go through everyone's answers, and he proudly stated, he was like, oh, my favorite film is The Lion King. And it's like, I think it was like, right, like the person who answered before him was like, oh yeah, like my favorite movie is Wolf of Wall Street or some Scorsese film. So it was very
I feel like out of the two, I would consider Lion King probably more classic than Wolf of Wall Street, to be honest.
But it was just like, I was just like, that's the energy that Mia and Noah have in these classroom bickerings. I'm like, it's very accurate.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's been really great having you on the podcast. You know, before we go, gotta ask. I know you're just coming off of your gauntlet of a 2025 writing wise. How's your 2026 look? Yeah, got any more books coming out?
Yeah, I'm actually working on my next like adult romance book. I can't reveal much about it yet, but I will say that it's an enemies to lovers book about two co-stars who hate each other to the point that they basically get involved in this like huge online feud, and that kind of makes people ship them to the point that they have to star in like a Korean drama movie together. So it's like this like fun like cultural clash, but also like, you know, like classic enemies to lovers book, and that's coming out sometime in like, hopefully, I mean, it might get pushed back, but sometime in late 2026.
That's just pure K-drama energy right there.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, Lila. It was so much fun.
Oh, thank you for having me. I enjoyed my time.
And that was Lila Lee. Her latest novel, The Cuffing Game, is available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Boba online bookstore. So if you're interested in picking up her book, as well as support us at Books and Boba, head on over to booksandboba.com and check out our online bookshop. All right, before we go, just a quick reminder that our November 2025 book club pick is Taiwan Travelogue by Yang Shuangzi, translated by Lin King, who our book club member Billy Rugo has let us know that she is the cousin of Allison King, one of our past author chats.
Oh, wow. That's like a fun trivia.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Taiwan Travelogue was the winner of the 2024 National Book Award for Translated Literature. And, you know, we haven't read like a translated book in a while. So I think this is a pretty good pick. Also, like, I feel like a lot of people are going to be traveling this month because of the holidays. So I feel like that's also appropriate.
Yeah, it is a story that takes place in Taiwan in 1938. So while it was still under Japanese colonial occupation, and is a bittersweet love story between two women nested in an artful exploration of language, history, and colonial power. So really excited to get into this book. It's been on my TBR for most of the year now. So I'm excited to get into it with all of you. If you are a Patreon supporter, we are discussing this book on our Discord. So be sure to check out the book club thread for the reading schedule. And for those of you who aren't on our Discord, you can also let us know your thoughts on the book by heading to our Goodreads forums. As always, we love to include your feedback on our discussion episodes whenever possible. But yeah, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again to Lila Lee for joining us, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rui Ryu, and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba, and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hungry for spicy food and even hotter conversations? Craving community and authentic storytelling? Then join the table. This is Minor Legends, a new comedy fiction podcast supported by Potluck. Pull up every week with me, Angela Wong Carbone, and follow the stories of me and my friends as we serve up tasty tales of what it means to be Asian American at our weekly dinner hang. If you enjoy deep dishing on absurd stereotypes like tiger moms who tutor your dating game rather than grades, the insanity of your parents' immigration story, to the legend of that one good Asian cousin you can never live up to, then pull up a seat and grab a plate. Featuring dinner guests like Ronnie Chang, Brian Park, Usama Siddiqui, Celia Au, Perry Young, Supriya Ganesh, and more. It's a tasty rotation that'll leave you belly laughing and steeped in relatable and spicy conversations. Can you take the heat? Listen now for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Kim Cooper, and I co-host the podcast Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone, especially for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stands. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.